For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're getting into Romans chapter 1. Tonight we're going to be opening up on a subject called general revelation. And I'd like to take a couple of 3 weeks and just dive into this, really explore this whole area pretty thoroughly if we can. General revelation. Special revelation is when God actually speaks to somebody, you know, gives them a message, a propositional message. Like the Bible is special revelation, okay? That's an actual verbal message transmitted. General revelation is ways that God reveals himself in a more general way and to a more general audience. Namely, you don't even have to read the Bible. What about all the people that never even have seen the Bible before? What about them? God says, I've got revelation for them too. General revelation. It's all over the place. Now, we ended last week in chapter 1 of Romans, verse 16, where Paul said, I'm not ashamed of this good news about Christ. It is the power of God at work, rescuing everyone who believes, the Jew first and also the Gentile. This good news, it's the good news tells us how God makes us right in his sight. So the good news is how we can get right with God, how we can be acceptable to him, even though we may be messed up pretty bad and we are living like, you know, way short of what he would expect. He can accept us anyway because we're all basically forgiven of everything past, present, and future that we do. And this all was accomplished by the death of Jesus Christ. God had to come in person through Christ, and that was what we were talking about last week. He says this is accomplished from start to finish by faith. And so what does he want from us? Just this. Just trust me. Trust that what I've done for you is good enough. Put your confidence in that, in the work of Christ. And then you and I can be together forever and there's no problem between us. As the scriptures say, it is through faith that a righteous person has life. Okay? That's where we left off last week. Now, he goes on and says, for the anger of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So he says, God's angry. And he's angry because people, he's saying, are suppressing the truth. That implies that they know, they sense what the truth is, but they don't want to face it, and so they're suppressing it. NLT translates it, people who push the truth away from themselves. It's not just that they didn't know or never thought about it before. Oh, man, never really thought about that. No, that's not the way it is. It's that I did think about it. I sensed where this was headed. I didn't like that conclusion. And now, so I'm just not going to think about it anymore. I'm going to deliberately suppress this. When I was a kid trying to get on a swim team, they used to have us swim the ball to the bottom of the 12-foot area in the pool. You'd get a volleyball, and you had to swim it down and plant it on the grate at the bottom. Well, for kids that size, it ain't that easy swimming that ball down there. And you could maybe get it there, but you could never hold it there for very long. It always would shoot back to the surface again. And I think this is exactly what happens when we set out to suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Now, why would someone want to suppress the truth? Well, we'll talk about that later. Let's keep reading now. I want to keep reading. He says, the fact is that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. This passage is saying everybody, unless I suppose they're unable to think at all, like precognizant, like infants, or maybe people who are severely mentally handicapped, you know, basically any normal person, it is evident within them that which is known about God, and God makes sure of that. God makes sure. He makes it evident within them. He says, for one thing, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they're without excuse. Okay? Through what has been made, i.e., we look out here at nature, okay? We look at the world, and we're seeing something that clearly tells us, okay, this didn't happen. This is not an accident. This is not an accident out here. In fact, that each of these, this invisible attributes of God, we can infer, we can deduce the attributes of God, the power of God, his nature, from what we see around us. And this is true whether you're a grade school child or the world's greatest scholar. Doesn't matter where you live. None of that matters. It's evident to everyone. It's clearly seen, he says. This is a reference, and he says, because of this, people are without excuse. So there must be something at that point. If you can tell that God must exist from what you see out in the world, then there must be some response that you can have at that point. Even if you've never seen the Bible, never heard of Jesus Christ or anything like that, there must be some way that you can respond. And there are indications right through the Bible, in fact, that this happens on a pretty regular basis. Not super often, but definitely happens. People that never heard the Bible before, and they find God through general revelation. Now, this is really an argument from design, okay, that we're looking at here. He's saying, you look at the design of things in the world, and it tells you there must be a God. And a few weeks back, we talked about the notion of fine-tuning in the universe. That's an argument from design right there. It's saying there's too much precision in the way these factors line up that had to be just exactly what they are in order for this type of universe to exist. And it's just too unlikely that would happen by accident. And so I'm not gonna get back into that again. Tonight I want to talk about a different type of argument from design. And this has to do with I just want to focus tonight on a life here on earth, life, the existence of life, okay? Here's how the argument from design works. I think this argument is super persuasive. It's been argued against by scholars, and you know, you can look at their arguments, see what you think. But I was a big doubter. I was not a believer in God at all, and for years, and eventually came to faith, but I had lots of troubles with doubt even after I met God. And this was one of the areas that solidified my faith incredibly and made me a strong believer. The first proposition is that the presence of design implies the presence of a designer. It's not a very controversial point. The question is, you know, what is design? There's where the rub is. What is design? Are we imagining that something's designed by thinking backward? Or is it really designed? How do we determine that? Okay. This is a bottle, and that's my hand there, holding that bottle. It's got inside of it a watch disassembled. I took this little watch apart. There's maybe 25 to 45 pieces, you know, screws, wheels, different things. Who knows what all those things are in there? But I got all of them in, so this is a complete watch, disassembled, and all the parts there in the bottle. Now you can imagine that I could just start to shake the bottle, and those pieces then would be colliding with each other, wouldn't they? Now these are pieces that are crafted to fit together. They are made. We know that they did fit together, right? And the question would be, how long would we have to shake the bottle before the watch, you know, would reassemble itself? Okay, we look at that, and I think we would all, if we're honest with ourselves, we all know this, the same. We'd get the same answer, which is never. That's never going to happen. Even though a designer has already been at work crafting these parts to fit together, to assemble them into a watch, no, that's not going to happen. You know, you could shake the watch faster, and you'd have more collisions. You could take 20 or let's say 100 watches apart, identical watches, put them all in the same bottle, and then you would have many more chances for the first wheel to be screwed into place, right? And yet, the fact is, we know, all of us know, this will never happen. Never. If we shake it hard, if we shake it for like a billion years, we'll get a pile of dust in there, but we will never get watches reassembled. That's not how it works. And we know this intuitively. You can tell that, you know, for one thing, it wouldn't do just to have, even if a wheel did get screwed on somewhere, you know, I mean, they can't be assembled. The pieces can't be assembled in places different than where they were originally. They have to be in a precise order. Now, maybe there's only about 30 or 40 pieces to this watch, but still, that's way too many to think that they would be assembled in the proper order to get a working watch. I don't think so. I don't think any of us believe that. Now, if that's the case, we look at that watch and we sensing there's design here, so to assemble it would require a designer. And it can't be just random collisions. Yeah, there's enough energy in the system. The proper pieces are in the system. But what is going to channel the energy into the work? There is a missing element, which is you need energy, you need the parts, and you need information. You need the information for how it's supposed to go, and that is absent from that model of the shaking bottle. Now, we all instinctively recognize design. Think of these, look at these interviews down on campus here. What do you suppose that is?
Well, it's hollow, so maybe it floats.
From something scientific or a baby toy.
It's kind of shaped like a bike seat.
Excellent. And could that be like maybe a Star Trek badge?
I have no clue.
Oops. Nah, it's fine.
Yeah, it must be some fixture.
I have absolutely no idea.
I don't know, honestly.
You broke it. Where do you suppose I could find something like that? I mean, does that
where?
Sort of thing grow on a tree? I mean, do I find it in the ground?
I would say go over to the engineering building.
I'd say the internet, because you can get just about anything there.
In a store or someplace like that.
At a pharmacy.
Craft store, maybe?
So why do you think it has a purpose?
It looks like it serves some sort of thing. It's got two pieces. It's got these little grooves, which looks like something has or could fit in.
My, rationalist indoctrination by Western civilization.
It's kind of the connectable parts, maybe.
I'm sure it has some purpose. I don't think people would make it otherwise.
Everything has a purpose.
It's molded into a shape. One piece fits into the other.
So it shows the evidence of a design of some sort.
Evidence that's been designed and made by human beings, yes.
You're to look at this thing and say, well, this is a man-made object, or this is designed. How do you know?
I don't know.
It's not naturally growing from the earth.
Because it had to be designed by someone and created.
It has to have been made by somebody.
Been created. Somebody had to make it. It just doesn't make itself on its own.
Do you think somebody made this thing?
Yeah, I think they made it for a certain purpose, I guess.
What evidence of, design or manufacturing do you see?
Symmetry.
Excellent, symmetry. What's that mean?
It means it's equal on both sides.
The geometry of some of the holes and the dividing line down the center.
And it's in a specific form and shape, and it fits together. I don't think it's natural.
It seems pretty standardized. I mean, it doesn't look too choppy. Seems pretty smooth, pretty man-made design of it, possibly.
Obviously placed together in some type of way, so it was human-made.
It's molded, it's shaped, it's perfectly shaped. Nothing naturally made would be this perfect.
Oh, yeah. They all see the same thing there. Not all of them are sure why, you know. Some of them were like, I don't know why, but they all see it. And that's what this passage is saying, too, that we can recognize, we can easily detect the presence of design. Now, my second proposition is that our world manifests the presence of design. In fact, at a very high level, extremely, incredibly high level of design here. And to illustrate that, I like to use one particular example tonight. abiogenesis, okay? Abiogenesis is the proposition that in a, you know, primordial ocean of some sort, that chemicals, compounds, in collision, combined in various ways, combined, separated, recombined, so forth, and that we happen to hit on a combination that came to life. And so biological life was generated from non-biological sources, non-living matter coming to life because the right arrangement of molecules occurred. Our question is that plausible or not? Is that believable that that happened? And I'm going to suggest to you tonight that it is not. It's not plausible. It's not possible. And it didn't happen. Consider a few things as we think about this. First of all, natural selection doesn't apply to this discussion. All right? Natural selection, Darwinian evolution, only applies to organisms that are already alive and reproducing mutations, causing some to be more adaptable and more survivable than others, right? That only happens once you already have life. So non-living compounds, chemical compounds, don't reproduce themselves, and therefore natural selection and evolution has nothing to do with this whole discussion. That's the first point. I don't think anyone would dispute that. Professor Coppedge states that the length of the average protein in the smallest known living thing is at least 400 amino acid lengths containing more than 7,000 atoms. All right, that's one protein molecule, the basic building blocks of the smallest unit of life on Earth, which is the cell. And they're very complex molecules with a high degree of specificity. You know how you have to assemble that watch with the right wheels in the right positions and so on. You can't just do them any way you want. It's the same thing here, where all 7,000 atoms in this very complicated, lengthy molecule have to be exactly where they are. If one of them is out of place, that's how we get sickle cell anemia. Even one misplaced unit can destroy the functionality of the entire protein. So they're very specific how they have to be built. Each living cell requires millions of protein molecules, all of them arranged into elaborate organelles that have very specific functions within a cell. I don't know where you've taken your bio 101 yet, but in one of the bios down here that used to be required, they get into cell biology. Very interesting. Man, I never knew there were like 20-some organelles within a cell. I mean, it's like a city in there, all the different things that are going on. Definitely, anything that's alive has to be able to do certain basic things. It has to be able to take in food, transform that food into energy to power the cell, and also into the building blocks of the cell, protein molecules, synthesizing proteins according to, and there are a vast array of proteins that have to be synthesized, different ones within each cell, and they have to be placed where they belong. And to be alive, to stay alive, you also have to be able to reproduce. Reproduction. That's all. Reproduction, digestion, and protein synthesis are minimum requirements, okay, to have something that's alive. All living things have that. Everything that's alive today has it, has all those things. Now, I want to show you another clip where we're going to zoom in to one component of that, which is the process of reproduction. And this is a clip about a guy named Dean Kenyon, who was a world-class scholar in the field of molecular biology. His quest to explain how these molecules of life were formed as a non-theist. He did not believe in God, so he is trying to come up with how this could have possibly happened. I'll let you watch the clip.
Proteins, like written languages or computer codes, have a high degree of specificity. The function of the whole depends upon the precise arrangement of the individual parts.
But what produces the precise sequencing of amino acids that gives rise to the specific shapes and functions of proteins? During the 1950s and 60s, discoveries about protein structure forced biologists to confront this mystery. Dean Kenyon believed he could solve it. In his book, Biochemical Predestination, Kenyon and his co-author, Gary Steinman, proposed an intriguing theory. Kenyon wrote, "Life might have been biochemically predestined by the properties of attraction that exist between its chemical parts, particularly between amino acids in proteins."
At the time that Biochemical Predestination came out, I and my co-author were totally convinced that we had the scientific explanation for origins.
Kenyon proposed that the chemical properties of the amino acids caused them to be attracted to each other, forming the long chains that became the first proteins, the most important components in the living cell. And this meant that life was effectively inevitable, predestined by nothing more than chemistry.
Many scientists embraced Kenyon's ideas, and over the next 20 years, Biochemical Predestination became a best-selling text on the theory of chemical evolution. Yet 5 years after the book's publication, Kenyon quietly began to doubt the plausibility of his own theory.
It was during that whole period of time that my doubts about certain aspects of the evolutionary account became apparent. When coming into contact with a powerful counter-argument given to me by one of my students, and I could not refute that counter-argument.
Kenyon was challenged to explain how the first proteins could have been assembled without the help of genetic instructions. In living cells today, chains of amino acids are not formed directly by forces of attraction between their parts, the scenario Kenyon envisioned on the early Earth. Instead, another large molecule within the cell stores instructions for sequencing the amino acids in proteins. It is called DNA.
Initially, Kenyon believed that proteins could have formed directly from amino acids without any DNA assembly instructions. And that's why so many scientists were excited about his theory. But the more he and others learned about the properties of amino acids and proteins, the more he began to doubt that proteins could self-assemble without DNA.
In DNA, Kenyon encountered a molecule with a property he could not explain through natural processes. For locked securely within its double helix structure is a wealth of information in the form of precisely sequenced chemicals that scientists represent with the letters A, C, T, and G. In a written language, information is communicated by a precise arrangement of letters. In the same way, the instructions necessary to assemble amino acids into proteins are conveyed by the sequences of chemicals arranged along the spine of the DNA. This chemical code has been called the language of life, and it is the most densely packed and elaborately detailed assembly of information in the known universe.
Like other scientists working on the origin of life, Kenyon realized he had two choices. Either he had to explain where these genetic assembly instructions came from, or he had to explain how proteins could have arisen directly from amino acids without DNA in the primordial oceans. And in the end, he realized he could do neither.
It's an enormous problem how you could get together in one tiny submicroscopic volume of the primitive ocean all of the hundreds of different molecular components you would need in order for a self-replicating cycle to be established. And so my doubts about whether amino acids could order themselves into meaningful biological sequences on their own without pre-existing genetic material being present just reached, I guess for me, the intellectual breaking point sometime near the end of the decade of the 70s.
As Kenyon reevaluated his theory, new biochemical discoveries further weakened his conviction that amino acids could have organized themselves into proteins.
The more I conducted my own studies, including a period of time at NASA Ames Research Center, the more it became apparent that there were multiple difficulties with the chemical evolution account. And further experimental work showed that amino acids do not have the ability to order themselves into any biologically meaningful sequences.
Faced with mounting difficulties in his own theory and a growing body of scientific data about the importance of DNA, Kenyon was forced to confront the absolute necessity of genetic information.
The more I thought about the alternative that was being presented in the criticism and the enormous problem that all of us who worked on this field had neglected to address, the problem of the origin of genetic information itself, then I really had to reassess my whole position regarding origins.
For Dean Kenyon, a new question became the focus of his search for life's origin. What was the source of the biological information in DNA?
If one could get at the origin of the messages, the encoded messages within the living machinery, then you would really be on to something far more intellectually satisfying than this chemical evolution theory.
Yet Kenyon realized that he faced a narrowing set of options. By the 1970s, most researchers had rejected the idea that the information necessary to build the first cell originated by chance alone. To understand why, consider the difficulty of generating just two lines of Shakespeare's play, Hamlet, by dropping Scrabble letters onto a tabletop. Then considered that the specific genetic instructions required to build the proteins in even the simplest one-celled organism would fill hundreds of pages of printed text.
Of course, a serious origin of life biologists did not believe that life had arisen by chance alone. Instead, they envisioned natural selection acting on random variations among chemicals to produce the first life. But there was a problem with this proposal.
By definition, natural selection could not have functioned before the existence of the first living cell, for it can only act upon organisms capable of replicating themselves, cells equipped with DNA that pass on their genetic changes to future generations.
Without DNA, there is no self-replication. But without self-replication, there is no natural selection. So you can't use natural selection to explain the origin of DNA without assuming the existence of the very thing you're trying to explain.
Chance, natural selection, and his own theory of self-organization had all failed to explain the origin of genetic information. Now Kenyon saw only one alternative.
We have not the slightest chance of a chemical evolutionary origin for even the simplest of cells. So the concept of the intelligent design of life was immensely attractive to me and made a great deal of sense, as it very closely matched the multiple discoveries in molecular biology.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, A molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
Well, I don't know whether you followed all of that, but, you know, I think it's pretty interesting when a guy like Kenyon, you know, a lot of this has only come to light in the past few decades. I'm still old enough to remember when a lot of this, back in the 60s, a lot of this was still not understood. This has really come to light in the 70s and the 80s, big time. Think about it. Let's go back to our proposition. The first living cell would have to be capable of self-propagation. That's that process we just watched with the DNA, the tRNA, the ribosomes, the fabrication of protein. All of that would have to be there in the first cell. It would also have to be able to feed. It would have to be able to create energy because all of those operations required energy. Science isn't as popular a subject to study as it used to be, but these cells are very complex, and they're all this way. There are no examples of cells. In fact, a lot of research has been done on how simple could a cell be and still be alive, still be able to, you know, what's the minimum that cells would have to have? And the conclusions that people are reaching is that even the minimalist, most simple, ridiculously simple cell would basically require almost everything that we have even in the most complex cells. There just isn't that much room for give here. These different organelles, very specialized, incredibly elaborate. It's worth taking a class in this if you never have. There's the process for the connecting, taking the DNA information out and eventually creating that protein that they just went through. A lot of these structures in the cells, very geometric. This is the nuclear port. They showed an opening to let the tRNA come through and so forth, and it will let some compounds through, others it will not. Good Lord. Structures so elaborate that they make that little blue thing those people were looking at look like a block of wood. You know, we're talking about something. If there's anything remarkable difference between that little blue object those people were looking at and what we're talking about here is just what a primitive, simple design that blue thing was. But nobody suspected that that wasn't designed and fabricated. We're looking at something so vastly beyond that. We're into a level of complexity here that is just mind-boggling. The mitochondria, where the Krebs cycle occurs. Complicated chemistry here that can turn fats or carbohydrates into energy. And so you have a score of these in every cell. There's the ribosomes taking these strands of protein to the endoplasmic reticulum, and where they're sorted out and guided out to the different parts of the cell. Or if it was poorly made and it's not good protein, dispensed and taken out like to a garbage dump and kicked outside of the cell. And so we have intercellular waste protein produced that way. Now, okay. Yeah, and you think, does that look like that's... no sign of design there. Here's the point, okay? You might not have understood some of what I've said so far. Don't miss this one, okay? The point is, all of these things have to be present in the first cell at once. Wouldn't do any good to have half of it, to have a quarter of it. All of these processes have to be there and functioning before you could have the first replicating cell. If it's not going to replicate, then it's just going to live and die. It's got to be able to replicate. It's got to be able to produce protein. It's got to have information. These proteins are too complex to happen. He said they've proven that amino acids cannot order themselves into meaningful biological sequence. They have to be directed how to order themselves, and that's information. And the information, which is in the incredibly complex DNA molecule, is a sure sign of design. We're talking about a brilliant plan here. We're talking about an order of intellect here that is staggering to have put together matter in such a way that it can reproduce itself in such a way that, yes, it can evolve. That too. We're not talking about, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, so you don't believe in evolution. And that's not true. I do believe in evolution. I think that's been demonstrated. But we're outside of that envelope here. And we are looking at design at an incredible level. No way to account for how it could have come about. No chance collisions cannot account for that. Cannot, will not. And we know that. I believe every one of us sitting here knows that in our heart. What are the chances that that happened by accident? None. People have sat down and tried to do these calculations of what are the chances of stuff, and it just ends up basically with impossible numbers. There is no chance of that happening. That's just not the way it works. And so we do see evidence of design right down at this molecular level, a design that would be incompatible with natural cause and effect, a design that had to be implanted by a designer. And if the presence of design implies a designer, and if our world manifests design, then a designer exists. And that is solid reasoning. It's not only that either. There's more, okay? It's not just that a designer exists, but also that this designer has to be sufficient to account for the design that we see. And so it turns out that we can also infer things about any designer that came up with a design like that. In the first part, vast intelligence. To come up with an idea like that. Why don't we take these adenine, guanine, thymine, cytosine would probably be good compounds here. We can just arrange those. We'll just put them into a, we can helix it like this, and then we'll just have it open up and just duplicate itself and go out, and then it can be. Oh my, that is such an incredible design. What kind of brilliance would it take to come up with something like that? I have no idea. Will, intent, you know, a lot of people presume and speak of a God who is really just sort of a force, you know, like, hey, may the force be with you, you know, and it's sort of a thing, it's sort of like gravity, or it's sort of like something that pervades all things, and it's, you know, all around us, and it's in me and you and everything. That wouldn't really explain what we see here. We need something that can think and form an intent, forethought, planning, and then go out and execute that plan. That's what we're seeing in that video we just watched. That's exactly what we're seeing right there. And so these are elements which have to do with something we call personality. This is a personal being we're talking about, not a thing, not a principle like gravity or electromagnetic attraction. This has to be some being who thinks, plans, executes according to an intent. We're talking about a personal designer. And that rules out quite a vast number of speculations that people have come up with on this. We can also see the immense power that it must take. And this not only has to do with the abiogenesis, but with the whole vast plan and the things that we discussed when we talked about fine-tuning come in here as well. And another thing I think that comes in is probably the implication of infinitude, because if this designer created all things, then the designer must have predated those things, and in fact must predate everything, and must be an uncaused cause. It must be something that's always been here. I think it's very likely we're seeing infinitude here as well. And so what do we have? We have a picture of an infinite personal God. Hey, here's something interesting. Now, if you don't like abstract stuff, you can just tune out here for a couple minutes. But I kind of think this is cool. When you look at religion in the world, there are thousands of religions, but they do break down into certain categories. And there are only just a few categories of types of religious worldviews, and you can count them on the fingers of one hand. You know, there is polytheism, animism, which posits, you know, thousands of gods that animate nature and so forth. There is pantheism, which posits a God that is in all, through all, and that all things are part of God, and in fact that he's sort of like this impersonal mass or whatever. And there is theism, which is the belief in an infinite personal God. A lot of people call it monotheism, which is also implied. The reason that monotheism is implied rather than polytheism has to do with it being infinite. Okay, but let's stay focused. Okay, so those three views, between those three views, that basically is going to take care of 99.9999% of all religious worldviews right there. Those three. Those are your choices. Polytheism, animism have gods who are personal gods, but they're not infinite. They can be fooled. They make mistakes. They mess each other up in the mythologies of the people. In fact, you can even get control over some of these gods if you know the right magic and the right words. You can get control over them and make them do your work for you. They're kind of like overgrown humans. They're bigger than us, but they're still finite. Pantheism, they pose a God who is infinite, yes, in all ways, but he's not personal. And neither one of those will account for what we see in General Revelation. What we need is a designer who is an infinite personal God. And where do we find that? You find it only in three significant complexes of religious thinking: Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. And that is very interesting because those are all three linked in an interesting way, which is that they all three draw their origins back to the same book. Isn't that interesting? I think that's really interesting. I don't think that's an accident. How come no one else came up with that idea? Well, we're going to talk about special revelation later. That's what that book is, a special revelation. Infinite, personal God. And there's other things you can deduce as well. We're going to talk about some more next week. You can actually deduce as well that this is a moral God, that he's moral. And the moral part, we're going to have to hold off on that. We don't have time for that tonight. All this is understood through what has been made. Now, let's go back to that previous verse. Remember this? It says that people suppress the truth in unrighteousness. When people will look straight at the facts, but they just don't want to accept it, and so they just suppress it, and they just come up with something else instead they'd rather believe. For some reason, a lot of people, no matter how much evidence they're given, simply would rather not believe in the infinite personal God. Now, they might believe in a God of their own making, a God who is more suited to what they want to believe in, but the actual God who's really there don't want anything to do with him, and so they will suppress the truth. Now, why would someone do something like that? You know, a lot of this has to do with the fact that people are frightened by the idea of God, that the idea of God scares them. They think, you know, you wonder if it's an infinite personal God, it could be, oh man, you know, what if he's mean? What if I run into him someday? What's going to happen? And, you know, it's just like the, oh man, so that just means I'm just the creature here. So I might have, he might want to tell me what I should do. I don't know if I want anything to do with that. We could come up with a lot of different reasons for suddenly starting to feel like, I'm not so sure I feel so comfortable thinking about this infinite personal business with God. And that pisses God off. Because we're being dishonest. We're saying, I sense this is true, but I'm just going to refuse to look at it. That's dishonest. We have the information. We have enough right in front of us to know that this is true, that he's there. And now we're going to pretend like, oh, I don't know, man, I'm not so sure. Yeah, you are sure, you know perfectly well. And you're being dishonest with yourself at that point. And it pisses God off. It's dishonest. It lacks integrity. A person with integrity would realize if they saw something and they realized this is true, looks like it's true, probably true, would have the guts to act on that and to follow the implications, whatever they may be. I mean, if this is the way reality is, we might as well face it. It's not up to us. We didn't create it. You know, we're not making it up. We don't get any vote on this, whether it's going to be. It's like, it is what it is, man. Reality is there. Have the guts to face it. And God wants us to have the integrity to call out to him. If we realize he's probably there, good Lord, I'm sensing he's probably there. A sense that you may well be feeling right as you sit here tonight, maybe feeling exactly that. Then you should have the integrity, you should have the guts to face him, the real God, and say, if you are there, if you are personal, you know, if this business is true about the good news and you like are turn out to be like a God of love and everything like that and everything, I hope that's true. I hope it's true that we can come to you free of charge. I hope it's true that you've come here and forgiven us for everything we've done, that you're going to rescue us out of the scene we're in and all that. Hope that's all true. And it's hard to see why you would not go to him at that point and say, well, is it or not? I mean, if he's personal, he should be able to answer, right? If he's God, he should hear you when you call out to him. We'll see later in this book, in chapter 10, he says, anyone who calls out on the name of the Lord will be rescued. You know, God is not going to be like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know about you. You know, it's like, what's in it for me? He's not sitting back reluctant to do this. You turn to him and say, God, I want in. I want to know you. He's like, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Now, I died for this. I paid a huge price to win you. I love you. And that is how you get to know God. What good reason would there be for not doing that right now? Are you going to be better able to do it tomorrow than today? Of course, there's something that rankles. We feel like, well, you know, I don't want to grovel. I feel like, you know, right now I'm calling the shots. I don't know whether. And truthfully, pride is the biggest barrier that we have. We have this intense pride where I don't bow to anybody, man. Nobody tells me what to do. And that's the reason that we suppress the truth. And no wonder then God gets pissed off after all that I've done. And all I'm offering you, and you're going to turn your nose up at it and act like you got a better idea, and you want to, out of pride? Give me a break. That is pitiful. It's pitiful. Turn to God. Call out to Him, honestly. And just say, you know, you say, well, I still feel some doubts. Fine. You know, that's never going to change. You never get to a point where I have no doubts now. I just can't doubt at all. You know, there's always a different possibility, a doubt, whatever. You never get to a point where, you know, so I've talked to people and they're like, wow, I just don't quite feel it yet. Dude, how do you know you're ever going to feel it? You don't need to feel anything. You just do the thing that has integrity, that is the right thing to do, to turn to God. That's all. Just do it. And it's not going to get any easier by putting it off. It actually gets harder the longer we put it off, the more we manufacture excuses for keeping on suppressing the truth. Well, next time we're going to learn that this argument from design is not the only reason that we're given. When we get into this area of general revelation, this is just one thing. Oh my God, there's several others. Some people think the others are more powerful than this. And we had to take a, you know, little time to think it through. For one thing, I think these are pretty helpful. I've used these in talking to people to help them see why they should consider God, and it works. I mean, a lot of people are like, wow, never heard that before, and they're like all over it. So I think it's good for that reason. The one we're going to do next week is called the presuppositional argument. Oh, man. Whew, I love this. This argument, this argument is so awesome. And it's complicated, too. And I like that part about it. I mean, these are not simplistic points we're making here. I mean, these things are weighty. I think you'll enjoy the presuppositional argument. It'll give you something to work on. Lord, we thank You in the first place that You're there. We would be in so much trouble if we were alone in this universe, headed toward a future of oblivion and non-existence. Anything we tried to do in the meantime would just be whistling in the dark. And instead we find that You are actually there. The signs are all around us, everywhere. And then to discover that You're also a God of great love, even self-sacrificial love, who would take it upon Yourself to win a way for us to live forever with You. Oh, man. Yes, sometimes it is. It's almost too good to be true, God. Just seems like, oh, I don't want to, you know, it's easy to get the feeling I don't want to sucker and just believe something because I want to believe it, you know, just because it's convenient to believe it. And yet we look at at concrete issues like this tonight and we realize that's not why. It's not why we believe it at all. We believe in You because You're true. Lord, I pray for people maybe sitting here at this moment thinking about giving themselves up to You and acknowledging You, calling out to You. And I would just pray that they would have the courage and the integrity to do that, God. There's no reason not to. If you're not there, I guess nothing will happen, huh? The very thing that holds people back from calling out to You in that way is that they're afraid maybe You will be there. That's why we suppress the truth. We don't want to suppress the truth anymore, Lord. We'd have no reason to suppress the truth. The truth is awesome. And so we come to You tonight. Those of us, God, who are believers, who have been walking with You, we pray that we'll remember these things that we studied tonight, God, any time that we're afflicted with doubt or start to become confused, that we can go back to the beginning points, that You are there. that you are what you are, and that that evidence is unrefutable, irresistible proof that you've given us. Thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.